Please the court. My name is Andrew Ehrenpreis. I represent appellant Tarsem Singh. This case is a case in which a juvenile non-citizen, non-permanent resident, was arrested by INS and was not subjected to the proper procedures that are set forth in the Code of Federal Regulations for processing, for arresting, processing, and releasing juveniles. I'd like to focus right now on the question of HCFR section 236.3, which I think is the key to, it's certainly one of the key provisions of this case that requires some attention.
Before you get into that, Mr. Ehrenpreis, where is Mr. Singh now?
Mr. Singh is in Chicago. Yeah, he's not here today, but he is.
Sorry, is he in detention? Or
no, he is free.
I thought I had seen a voluntary departure order.
He did take voluntary departure, but that will only become a voluntary departure order if the appeal is dismissed.
Okay.
Now, 236.3, we contend, directly implicates due process notice requirements, which means that if it's not followed, it means that the service of the NTA is defective under the Fifth Amendment. Now, there is, of course, a split among the circuits on this question.
How does this apply when the person tells the agents he's 19 years old?
Well, I can get into that, actually, right now, Your Honor.
That's why I'm asking you. Thank you.
Yes. We contend that he did not tell the NTA that he was 19 years old. We contend that he presented a passport.
Based on what evidence?
He presented a passport, Your Honor, that shows that he was born in 1982.
I believe there are four passports, four copies of birth certificates with four different dates in the record.
Yes, I think that is correct. And I think the key to seeing why it is that the ones that say that his birth date is 1982 are the most likely ones to be correct, that they are correct, is that they say Tarsem Singh on them, which is his original name. He then later changed his name, and he's admitted to all this. He changed his name after... He changed his name to Simranjit Singh, at the behest of his father. And therefore, there are all these subsequently forged documents that say that his name is Simranjit Singh. Many of them say that his birth date is February 4th, 1978. There apparently are others that say it's something else.
Yes, there are.
Yes. But the key fact is the question is what the INS was led to believe and what the facts really were at the time. And he submitted a copy of a passport that was confiscated by the INS at the day of his arrest. That copy says that his name is Tarsem Singh, that his birth date is...
Are any documents that he's provided reliable?
That document is reliable.
Why? Why that one and not the other ones that
conflict
with it?
Well, that and the birth certificate, Your Honor.
There are no original birth certificates, correct?
There's a birth certificate...
Sorry, there are translations, and all of them indicate different dates, right?
I believe that they would all have been... I'm not sure whether the original birth certificate, the copy of the original birth certificate, I'm not sure whether it's a translation or not. It may not be because it's India, and so it may be in English. But
let me ask on the report from the July 30th, 1997 stop shows the date of birth 5/21/78, which would have made him 19 years old. Mm-hmm. Is it your contention the INS officers made that up?
I'm contending that they made an error, that it was akin to a typo writing down the wrong year. And I'll explain why. First of all, partially the passport, he submitted a copy. Apparently there is no, the actual passport that was confiscated, and clearly there was a passport confiscated, is not in the record. It's not clear why. But we have a copy of a passport that Mr. Singh contends is a copy of the passport that was confiscated. The number of the passport matches the number of the passport listed on the I-213. But more importantly, the INS was treating him as if they believed he was a juvenile. I think that is really the key to understanding this. They released him into the custody of an adult. Why would they have done that if they had believed him to be an adult himself? Okay? They then proceeded to have this adult, Rakesh Kapania, who is non-relative, fill out an affidavit of support, which suggests that they believed that 236.3 applied. Actually, it's the legacy. Well, 236.3 applied. The release provisions of it applied. They've then failed to follow it, you know, not only to the letter but in spirit, because what they failed to do was they failed to have him execute an agreement to ensure Mr. Singh's presence at all future hearings, which is a crucial.
If the petitioner was actually 19 at the time of this arrest, was the notice he received sufficient?
If he was 19, I believe it probably would have been.
Yeah.
Although I think we would still have. Well, no, I believe that's correct. Yes.
Okay. If suppose we accept your argument that. I mean, I frankly have no idea how anybody in the Immigration Authority is supposed to sort out any true fact concerning Mr. Singh. But suppose we were to agree with you that his due process rights were violated in connection with that 1997 notice. The case has been reopened. He's had ample due process, and the immigration judge still found him removable. You're contending, in what I gather is sort of swinging for the fences, that the 2014 remedy for the 1997 due process violation should be just erase the whole record. The whole proceeding should be terminated, and given the reopening that has occurred, I don't understand how there is any viable due process theory at this point.
Well, Your Honor, we cite cases in our reply brief, that show that a person can appear in court for the purposes of challenging the legality of the NTA, of the proceedings themselves, and that does not, in fact, constitute a remedy for the whole violation. We certainly stand by that argument. However, by the same token, if the court were to find that there were these violations and that they were remedied in 2014, or more likely in 2010, then we would accept that, because that would actually get Mr. Singh where he wants to go, which is to be eligible for cancellation of removal. It would mean that the stop time rule went into effect in 2010, not in 1997.
Now, if you want him to be eligible for cancellation of removal. He appears to have admitted marriage fraud with his first marriage, right?
Yes, that's correct.
What effect does that have?
It happened outside of the 10-year period. Now, certainly it's something
count?
That we can...
Sorry? Does it not count?
It doesn't make him statutorily ineligible. It is certainly something that a judge will consider when deciding whether
And we also have what looks like a finding of intent to deny, arguing that the second marriage is fraudulent.
Well, that we have contested.
What's the
and
status of that
proceeding? There's no finding that it was fraudulent.
What's the status of that proceeding?
The status is that, well, I'm explaining that. It was denied, but that is not the same as the finding that it was fraudulent. It was not. There was no finding of fraud, only that he failed to meet the burden of showing that it was a bona fide marriage, notwithstanding the fact that he has two children with his wife.
You're in your rebuttal time, you know.
Okay, I will.
All right, thank you, counsel. Mr. Spurlock.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Matthew Spurlock on behalf of the United States. When petitioner was arrested and detained in 1997, he informed the immigration officers at that time that he was born in 1978, and he informed the immigration officers at that time that he had arrived in the United States just 7 days prior in New York, being smuggled, and he didn't know exactly how he was brought into the United States, but he also testified that he arrived without inspection or admission. After he was released, his father picks him up approximately 2 weeks later, and he travels to Chicago with his father. Upon arriving in Chicago, he discusses the detention with his father, and his father decides at that time, we need to get you a new identity, becomes nervous learning that he was detained in Virginia, and after that, he decides you need to get a new birth date and a new identity. He then contacts the petitioner's mother, who's living in India, who sends a fraudulent passport to petitioner with a birth date now of 1978, which is exactly, just coincidentally, what he told INS his birthday was when he was detained in Virginia. It's true that he did provide INS a passport that indicated he was born in 1982, which would have made him 15 years old. But in this case, the board properly found the petitioner was properly served personal notice to appear for his immigration proceedings. And the I-213 in this case clearly indicates that petitioner was born in 1978, and he was not inspected or admitted in this case. And in this case, this court's own case law under Pujova, the I-213 is inherently reliable evidence of what the petitioner would have discussed with the INS officers. And there's nothing to indicate that there's any sort of unreliability with that I-213, that it shouldn't be believed. And also, even if petitioner, as he asserts, was 15 years old when he was detained in Virginia in 1997, he was still properly served under the applying regulations. Now, the petitioner is making much of 8 CFR 236.3. That is not the regulation that controls proper service of a parent, proper notice of a parent, I'm sorry. What that controls is the custody and release of juveniles. And this exact issue was completely rejected by the board in matter of Kubor. And as Petitioner's Counsel noted, in at least two circuits, they've also rejected this argument that 236 controls in these situations. In fact, anybody who is 14 and older does not need to be personally, does not need a responsible adult or a parent to be personally served. It's fine to serve the juvenile who is 15, 16, 17, 18 years old with service. And matter of Kubor addresses that specifically. Petitioner also discusses the fact that he was not served in English or provided an English translation, and that, he argues, was also a due process violation. But under this court's decision in Nazarova, the court found that that service in your native tongue is not required. And in fact, found specifically that the INS is not required to maintain the ability to provide a translation of your notice of appear for every single language.
Mr. Spurlock, can I ask, the board's opinion here acknowledges that Mr. Singh told the officers in 97 that he was 19 years old, but it seems to treat as a fact that he was 15.
I think what the board did, Your Honor, was initially said, it appears that he was 19, but even if he was in fact 15 at the time he was arrested, you still don't have a due process violation because you have compliance with the regulations that control how service is supposed to occur. There was no violation of that regulation.
It seems to just say the respondent was 15 years old at the time he was apprehended by immigration officers. Now that is quite different from the finding of the official who considered the second wife's I-130 application, who said, looking at all these different documents, it looks to me like he was born in 78.
As I said earlier, it's very confusing to know exactly what time or what age everyone believed him to be when he was detained in 1997. In fact, in USCIS's notice of intent to deny his I-130 application, they said that from all the documents, all the birth certificates, passports that we have, the majority seemed to indicate he was born in 1978. But based on his passport that he gave to the immigration officials in 1997, even assuming he was 15 years old at that time, there was still no violation of the regulations and service was still proper.
Is it correct that the passport, the copy of the passport has been submitted together with the I-213 report, we don't know whether that passport's copy is accurate or not.
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor. It's not 100% clear if that's there was confusion about whether that passport was the exact one that was submitted to the INS officers, or in reading the transcript, it was not clear at all at that point. And also, petitioner also makes a sort of general due process argument that this service that occurred, despite the fact that it complied with the regulations, somehow still violated due process. But if you look to the fact that even by his own testimony, when he was released and his father comes and picks him up in Virginia and brings him to Chicago, even based on the fact that his father at that point said, you need to find a new identity and we need to get you a new passport. In fact, he didn't change his name. He assumed a new identity with an entirely new birth date. That's what his father told him to do. That clearly indicates that there was some sort of notice that he was in some sort of upcoming immigration proceeding or some sort of problems that he decided to, instead of dealing with the immigration proceeding, simply assumed a new passport, a new identity. And also just to touch on even assuming that there was a due process violation in the service of his notice to appear, even assuming that's true, this case was reopened. When the petitioner made a motion to reopen and a motion to terminate proceedings, the government didn't oppose the motion to reopen. The order in absentia was rescinded and the case was reopened at that time. So petitioner, as the board correctly found, petitioners failed to show any prejudice in this case because the case was reopened. Petitioner relies on a matter of Huete, and in that case, all the board did in that case was upheld the immigration judge's decision to terminate proceedings, but it wasn't a mandate that proceedings be terminated. And plus, that case was very different on its facts, just in the fact that there was no personal service in that case. That case involved service by certified mail, which was returned as no one living at that address. So on its facts, it was a very different case. The board here found reopening was the correct and the proper remedy for an in absentia order of removal, and that's consistent with this court's case law in Peralta Cabrera, where the alien seeking to challenge a deportation order in absentia has but one option to move to reopen the hearing, and that's what occurred in that case, and that's the proper remedy in this case as well. To address the petitioner's argument that the prejudice in this case is that he's now no longer able to apply for cancellation of removal, there's several problems with that argument. The first problem with it, it's not exhausted. He never applied for cancellation of removal before the immigration judge. He never told the board that he was going to, that was one of the factors that he misses out on if the proceedings aren't terminated. It was never raised as an issue for prejudice. In his reply brief, petitioner says, clearly we were going to apply for cancellation, but we didn't do so because it would have been futile to do so because we would have been rejected by the immigration judge. That doesn't satisfy the obligation to exhaust the issue before the agency, which is what he did not do in this case. Moreover, he argues in his reply brief that he did raise it before the immigration judge by saying, we would be entitled to the cancellation and removal, but we can't have the 10-year stop date because of the fact that it was reopened. But in fact, if you look closely at what the transcript says on page 100 of the certified administrative record, that was actually the immigration judge speaking in his conversation with government counsel when they were talking about the ramifications of his pending I-130 at that time. The immigration judge, frankly, was just thinking out loud, well, if he doesn't get termination of proceedings, he's not going to be eligible for cancellation of removal. So the immigration judge was aware of it, but this wasn't raised as a possible remedy by the petitioner. So therefore, he's not shown prejudice in this case. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Spurlock. So, Sir Aaron Priest, I think your time had expired. 2 minutes. You have 2 minutes left.
Let me first just say that I did raise it. I think if we look at that portion of the record, it will say that I explain why it is we want to terminate, because it will, because of the stop time rule, it will make him eligible for cancellation removal. And it is in fact the case that it was clearly futile to apply for cancellation if the IJ had not granted the motion to terminate, because clearly a stop time rule would require the judge to pre-termit the application. So I think that's the classic futility exception to exhaustion. I think also, we look at this, talking about this passport, the passport that we're relying on as and which appears to be the passport that Mr. Singh provided to the INS on the day of his arrest, there was no reason why it would have been forged at that point. He did forge a bunch of, he or other people forged a bunch of documents subsequently, but a document that he was holding in his possession on that date with his real name.
But nobody has the document.
Well, we have a copy of it, but there's but the
when was the copy made and submitted to the INS?
We submitted the copy to the immigration court. I don't know
in
why there was
a,
I'm sorry?
In 2010.
Yes. There was no well, there was no reason ever anyone ever would have submitted anything there was
right.
before that. Right. So, you know, I think that that shows that there's no reason to treat the I-213 in this case as inherently reliable on the question of his birth year. Okay. As to why we should follow the Ninth Circuit approach versus the Fifth or the Eighth, it's because the Fifth or the Eighth ignore the fact that 236.3 requires that they ensure that the adult custodian, that they agreed that the, to ensure that the juvenile attend future hearings. That clearly, thank you.
All right. Thanks to both counsel. Case is taken under advisement.